Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, good news. It's a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show with us, so please do tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teachersloungeatniu.edu. This week, it is the second and final part of our conversation with Northern Illinois University Distinguished Teaching Professor Dr. Gulsat Eigen. Gulsat is a world-renowned linguistics teacher, author, and translator. She has had an absolutely remarkable life, from growing up in Turkey, spending time as a political prisoner in the 1980s, coming to the U.S. to study at Harvard, and now teaching at NIU. We went through all of that in the last episode and about the ultimate goal of education. And in this part of our conversation, we talk about her experience growing up and learning English as a student in Istanbul and the journey that led her here to Northern Illinois University. And before we jump back into that conversation, we've got a few other education stories we want to share. Before they can get a teaching license, students spend months working in classrooms as student teachers, but they don't typically get paid. And I got the chance to report on several bills in the Illinois General Assembly looking to change that. Megan Lavery almost had to let go of her teaching dream. Twice. As an undergrad, she changed her major when she realized she couldn't afford to spend a semester paying for school, but not being paid to work. Years later, she held on to the dream. She worked as a school paraprofessional by day and took classes by night to finally get her teaching degree. But she still had to complete student teaching, and now it was even harder since she was raising a young daughter and utilizing state benefits.
I had to give up my home and my apartment and move in with extended family in order to be able to swing that unpaid semester. It was not a great choice for me or a great situation living, but it was like what I had to do because I just couldn't afford to be unpaid.
She finished her student teaching and has been a teacher for over 15 years. She teaches at Libertyville High School now. There are over 5,000 student teachers in Illinois every year. Chris Lowe is the Director of Student Success for the College of Education at Northern Illinois University. And he says that NIU can't directly compensate student teachers in their program.
That's partly because it is considered coursework. So they're enrolled in a class, they're paying for the class. That class is that experience. And so that muddies the waters a little bit.
Lowe says that their students can get paid by the district they're student teaching at, but it's rare for that to happen. Most don't get directly compensated at all. He says that Rockford Public Schools is the only district in their region that he knows pays student teachers. Vicki Gardner is the recruitment director at RPS, and she says they have two different programs. The district has been running its Aspiring Teacher program for the last 8 years. Student teachers in that program work for the entire school year as opposed to the usual semester or so. She says their 18 aspiring teachers are all at the elementary level. They make $20,000 for the year and are eligible for health benefits.
While it certainly is not what a full-time teacher makes, it's a heck of a lot more than traditional student teachers make.
The aspiring program is funded directly from the district's budget and also compensates the cooperating teachers. They're the full-time teachers who house student teachers in their classroom and coach them through the process. But through aspiring, they're compensated because they also take on a larger leadership position in their building. RPS also has a new program funded by the state's teacher vacancy grant. It pays $6,000 for one semester and includes other amenities to try to attract student teachers from schools outside of Northern Illinois.
We also have free apartments available where the individuals would pay for some utilities, but the rest of it we are covering. They're fully furnished.
Right now, RPS is the exception. State Representative Laura Favor Diaz, a former teacher, says that in fact, some Illinois universities prohibit student teachers from taking compensation, even if the money comes from a school district and not the college. She's the sponsor of one of two bills in the state legislature that aims to compensate student teachers. Her bill, if fully funded, would provide all student teachers with a $10,000 stipend for a semester of work. The other bill is very similar, but would prioritize low-income student teachers. State Representative Anna Mueller is another co-sponsor, and she also went through student teaching, and she compared the traditional student teaching experience to an unpaid internship that creates significant financial barriers for low-income students.
They are performing a service. They are working with students, they are performing a job, and therefore they should be paid.
Lavery, the Libertyville teacher, is glad to see it. Lavery's been a cooperating teacher, too, and she says she's never been compensated for that either. Another part of Representative Favor Diaz's bill creates a stipend for cooperating teachers as well. Her bill would distribute up to $1,500 for them. And she says those teachers can really set up a student teacher for success.
If you have an effective cooperating teacher who is effective in the classroom and at mentoring you, you can enter the profession teaching at a third year level.
She says that paying student teachers not only helps them, but also helps the students who get more engaged teachers, ones who may not have to work odd jobs when they're not in the classroom. And it could bring even more potential teachers into the field who otherwise can't afford the financial burden of student teaching. And recently, the DeKalb School District broke ground on its new elementary school and revealed its name, and I got to be there to learn more. The school will be called the Dr. Leroy A. Mitchell Elementary School after the DeKalb pastor and educator. Mitchell was the longtime director of Northern Illinois University's Chance program, which provides personalized support for traditionally underrepresented students. He's also the pastor emeritus of New Hope Missionary Baptist Church.
If we give young people a vision that they can see and find is very real, they'll make it. And that's what we need to help kids do. We're not going to be here forever.
Come on now.
And we've got to move out of the way and allow some other people to take over and do greater things.
Dr. Leroy A. Mitchell Elementary is in DeKalb's North Corridor, or Uptown neighborhood, which is home to nearly a third of the district's elementary school students. The district plans to open the new school in the fall of 2025. All right, now it's time for our conversation with Dr. Gulsat Aygin. We start off by talking about how she got interested in linguistics in the first place, and without any further ado, it's Dr. Gulsat Aygin.
That's a tough question, because growing up, as we talked about, language per se was not my primary interest in the sense of understanding what language is. I saw it as a tool. And I was rewarded when I was getting better at it, reading and writing, because my father was a literature scholar. So it was more about learning, and learning requires language. That's why I became literate so young, because I was jealous of my older brother and sister who were reading, and I couldn't. So I couldn't wait, to be honest. So language was a means for a long time, and I had a wonderful teacher in my American high school that I went to a private school, which you get into with exams, etc., in Istanbul, a former missionary school founded by American missionaries, where I had wonderful teachers, and I had a really amazing biology teacher, Dr. Yuanoglu, who was a doctor, a medical doctor, and who taught us genetics, etc., which mesmerized me. That's why I was led into medicine, and I wanted to serve the underserved community in Turkey, etc. I had ideals already by that time. I had many wonderful teachers, Dr. Canfield, our Shakespeare teacher, who would jump into the garbage bin to distract us in class so that we would pay attention. Phenomenally impressive teacher. My early on English teachers, I should say, really intrigued me about language. I mean, my Turkish teachers, you know, teaching me Turkish language, they were fun, but I had already had that environment at my home, so there was nothing new in school for me in that sense. But my especially initial English teachers at this American high school, where you go after starting with sixth grade, you go through an education only in English for a year. It's called a special year because the rest of the education is in English. So I had many American teachers there, Miss Mantley, Mr. Scott. I can still name them. I think Scott lives in Missouri or Mississippi somewhere. I salute her. I doubt that she will hear this, but I was very impressed by them in different ways. First of all, I was learning another language by being immersed in it. And in a shocking way, that was the former, you know, pedagogy. They just let you in and you got to swim out of it.
They dropped you from the helicopter into the Amazon.
Exactly, but without the linguistics training. So, yeah. but of course, you're younger, so it's easier at that point, although it's still a non-native language for me because I was already in puberty, I believe, at that time. So then you don't learn any language as a native tongue afterwards. So I was very intrigued by the differences between Turkish and English to begin with. Word order is different, many grammatical properties.
Vowel harmony.
Vowel harmony just drops off. You're very good. Yeah, Turkish has vowel harmony. English doesn't. How weird is that? And all those weirdnesses were presented to me through these amazing people. I remember thinking, so I owe it to them initially, I think, you know, apart from my upbringing, and mentally Mr. Scott, who also led us into social service to serve underserved teenagers, unlike us, who were more privileged, although I was on scholarship, but I was privileged. So I remember thinking, leaving the campus at 4 p.m. every day, I was not a boarding student, thinking, oh my God, Miss Bentley is still here. Mr. Scott is still here. They live on campus. And they're so far away, thousands of miles away from their homes and, you know, friends and family. And why? They're here to teach me English? I would be mesmerized and I would be in awe, admiring them and feeling so sorry for them because I was going home. They were not. That was very important. I think that also led me into teaching. And I have to share this anecdote. At some point when I started teaching at NIU, 1 or 2 years into it, somebody published the history. One of my former teachers published a book on the history of my high school, American Academy for Girls in Istanbul. And I learned that some of my teachers, not many, but a few of our teachers were from, guess where? Northern Illinois, which used to be the Illinois State Teachers College.
Yeah.
So I saw my life coming to a full circle. You know, I felt so bad about Miss Manley, Mr. Scott, Dr. Canfield, you name it, Miss Morgan. Having traveled 6,000-7,000 miles to teach me, and here I am returning the favor. So
that's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. Like, my life has such really interesting things or events, I should say. So they were the first ones that got me into thinking about language. Then I went into medicine because of my political activism. I was arrested along with another million people or so, and in prison linguistics came about because I was teaching English and learning German and French from friends who spoke those languages, and especially that Morse alphabet medium for the sounds, using the sounds of a language, they intrigued me. And I knew about Chomsky by then. But I knew him as a political person. I didn't know anything about linguistics per se. So after my release, I, you know, was reading avidly because we didn't have books most of the time in the prison. So I was reading a lot, and of course I read Chomsky's books, and then I learned he is a linguist. Meanwhile, I was trying to make a living by tutoring, teaching. I had already taught English in prison without the training. So, you know, I did, first I started doing it without getting the training. I doing it by studying, you know, sources and volunteering. So I volunteered teaching languages, English per se, to many women, primarily oppressed women in Turkey who could use language, English, to get out of their, you know, misery and poverty and what have you. I did that by volunteering, and which also taught me a lot about learning or about teaching languages on the way, you know. And then I went back to school and studied it and continued to do, and I translated a lot. So I was making a living on translating and tutoring and teaching. I ended up finding, collaborated with a seasoned teacher to start a language school and a translation school, and through which I had so many questions, you know, teaching Turkish to foreigners, English to foreigners, expatriates in Turkey, and English to Turkish people, businessmen, you know, famous artists, what have you. I became a very popular famous teacher there. But with their questions, you know, because they're one-on-one or small groups of diplomats studying Turkish. So they would ask questions. So I learned a lot from my students, and I would go study and do research to answer those questions. And I found out that there were some questions there were no answers to. So I made a list of them, and I said, okay, I'm studying linguistics. I need it. I mean, I'm already reading all about it, but let me do some formal training. So because I got excited about it, especially translations, you know, I did a lot of translation work, and I did a little bit of journalism in that sense.
Yeah.
Nothing like you. I have all the respect for journalists. You are an important engine of democracy and our society. So salutations to you. And all those unanswered questions brought me to many, you know, I wrote my thesis and many publications and came to MIT and Harvard. And when I was admitted by both, I had to go with Harvard because I still didn't have a passport. They were not giving my passport. And when you say I'm going to MIT, nobody understands it. And MIT stands for the acronym of the Central Intelligence in Turkey. So it's like, what are you doing? So I had to come to Harvard because that name gave me my passport at the end. So that was the path into linguistics, unanswered questions. So without questions, I wouldn't go back to formal education. Why should I at that age? And when I do have, you know, adult students and my mature students with kids and this and that, when they come back to college, they're usually the best students, of course, because they want to learn. They know why what they want to learn. So with questions, you build on. And linguistics then, of course, combined with my political interests in, you know, social activism and justice and all kinds of efforts for freedom.
Person that that nominated you mentioned your interest in Kurdish language rights.
Exactly. So yep. Linguistic rights in general, I did publish two Kurdish grammars in English. I mean, there are many Kurdish scholars who are producing it, but the Western world was not aware of it at the time. And Kurdish happens to be one of the minority languages spoken in Turkey. And until 2012, it was not allowed to be taught at schools, etc. And since then, it is allowed at least as an elective course. I'm more interested in the general human rights, of course, and linguistic rights is part of that because it touches individual lives in major ways. There are studies on such cases, mostly done in Europe. Now we're doing similar studies here in America too, in the US. A patient goes to a hospital. Actually, it was a Finnish patient going to a Swedish hospital or vice versa, doesn't speak the language. There was no common language spoken and couldn't express the agony, the pain, what they were going through. And they were so helpless because they don't give you in ER, they don't give you automatically some painkillers because they need to figure out what's going on before they numb their pain. And the patient was so desperate, they threw themselves off the balcony and died. Now, this is a violation of human rights. It is a violation of a linguistic right. So every medical institution has to have all kinds of translators, if necessary, machine translation. So one's native language rights does not always pertain to, you know, people coming from remote parts of the world. We were talking about Europe here, right? You know, Kurdish was close to my heart because, you know, it was not allowed when I was in prison. And there was, I heard of a fellow inmate, I should call, a prisoner. And we were not convicted. I mean, I was not convicted, but, you know, in the end, but after 6 years, there was a big earthquake in eastern Turkey, in their town or village, including their town, and everyone died. And there was one surviving person, an elderly, I think a grandma or somebody, who didn't speak Turkish, who came to visit the grandkid in prison, but she only spoke Kurdish, and it was not allowed. So they just cried facing each other. I didn't see it. It was reported to me by another fellow prisoner. It was horrible. I will never forget that moment. So that is a violation of human rights. You know. So now, of course, it's not as horrible. It is not the same in Turkey, but we always have room for more improvement, for giving the right for native language education and usage everywhere. In America, too, you know, we don't have an official language, which you, you know, everybody thinks we do, but we don't. So English is a de facto, you know, official language. But we are now accommodating, you know, other languages into our system. I have volunteered, and I also worked as translator, interpreter in the area hospitals in Chicago for the communities whose languages I speak. So we're on the right track, but linguistic rights are extremely important. So my current, you know, upcoming research-based book includes this, so that in the classroom, linguistic rights in the classroom and outside the classroom, so that we don't disparage each other or, you know, insult each other by criticizing anyone's language use, and focusing on communication. Because we are in a school setting, we are harming them by expecting them to speak standard language, which is not even a living language, for God's sake. I mean, even professors, I mean, forget about my accent and whatnot. I mean, professors in academia don't speak this standard language 24 hours a day. No way. So why are we imposing it and expecting it and treating each other unfairly because of that? So this is a bigger issue than a certain community. You know, Kurdish rights were close to my heart because of that experience. And it's my home country back, you know, but it is a much bigger issue than that, in which we participate, each and every one of us participate. And I'm sorry to say, of course, journalism and the publishing world continues to reinforce that kind of pressure among everybody. So we are all part of that system. So what I'm trying to do is actually surface it, bring it to the surface, to the consciousness of everybody, so that they don't consider it a privilege or a disadvantage, either way.
I've only got one or two more questions for you. And the one I have to ask is, we talked about your educational journey. How did you end up here at Northern Illinois University?
There are multiple answers to that question, all of which are true. I'm not going to tell all of them, give all the answers in detail, sure, because they're part of my, again, upcoming book as well. But when I graduated as a foreign national, I had an opportunity to work for a year. You know, you get what we call optional practical training. You get if you have a degree from an American higher degree, you know, a graduate school degree from a higher education institution in the U.S., you are given 1 year working permit. It's kind of an extension of your training, yeah, for which Harvard hired me to teach. So, and then, of course, you either get a tenure track job or you're out of the country. So I was thinking at that point, and my siblings were living here in America. Even my mother was living here in America at the time, and she passed away here. I was planning on going back to Turkey. But I said to myself, you know, I wanted to explore academia at its best, which I did at Harvard and MIT, and as a learner. Let me experience academia as faculty first. If not, I thought I can do, because I didn't go for the diplomas. You know, what I'm advocating to my students has been true for myself. I mean, I was already a certain age, and I had a long CV, and I already was making a living back home, and I could just go back and, you know, open a new private school or do something else, or I could go elsewhere in the world. I was also thinking about joining an NGO somewhere in Africa, so all the options were open in front of me. I did not necessarily have to do this. So I gave myself that year to see if I can get a job in academia in America and experience that. I didn't know what it would be like in Turkey because of the political climate at the time. So I thought I should give it a try here. But if I can't get a job, you know, tenure track job or something meaningful, I was going to go back. And, you know, the academic positions are very rough, very tough to get because there are so few. I mean, I'm a theoretical syntactician, interfaces, etc. How many theoretical linguistics positions open up in a year? You think? Very, very few. So I remember there was one postdoc position for a year at Northwestern University, and there was Memphis at the time, University of Memphis, and NIU. I have to confess that was all there was that year. And I talked to my previous chair at Harvard, and I said, what should I do? And they said, he said, never mind the postdocs, you know, if you can get an offer elsewhere, you'll still, you know, if you get a tenure track offer. And interestingly, my other colleague at Reed was on the job market too. So we were both shortlisted at Northern Illinois. And I got the job. And I got the, you know, I got other offers, but I preferred NIU under the circumstance. I didn't have a lot of options. I'm being very honest, but you know, and I didn't know about NIU or DeKalb until then. I have to admit, I came for a job in February from Portland. There was a snowstorm, for God's sake. You know, as usual now. And I ended up, and the of course, even the campus, you know, architecture and everything was different for, based on my experiences and private institutions. But I, you know, through my interview process, I really liked my future colleagues to be in terms of their approach, because I had, you know, been through in, you know, other job talks, etc. I saw that there was not as much adversity embedded in the process. You know, the East Coast, Ivy League, et cetera, they're, you know, competitive, really competitive voices. Whereas I was embraced with a different kind of aura here. And, you know, two of my best friends at Harvard were from the Middle East. I'm sorry, Midwest. I'm from that area.
Yeah. Same thing.
So, and they were my best friends. They were so, you know, collegial, and I worked with them. So that was really positive. So I preferred, of course, NIU in that respect. And then I came here and I said, let me experience this. I did not necessarily, it was good to know it was a tenure track position. I was not 100% sure I was going to stay for the tenure. I was still thinking, you know, because that's how I think about life. You know, I don't necessarily, because I believe our goals are paths. You know, the goal per se doesn't matter as much. It's where it leads you that matters and what you learn on the way. So I didn't know I was going to stay this long, to be honest, because there were other positions opening up and I was invited to apply to two positions. But I thought, let me give it a try here. And then if I want, I can go elsewhere, because I also got an offer from Korea, South Korea, and not North, of course. In many other places internationally as well. I even back in Turkey, I was invited, but, and then I stayed because I wanted to experience it, because this was a new America for me. I mean, the Midwest and the NIU setting was very different from my experience in the East Coast and the West. So this was still a learning curve, and I liked that challenge. And then once I stayed, I got early tenure. They were very kind to tenure me quickly based on my work. And they were good in acknowledging my efforts. They gave me awards and what have you. And I had very good friends with their hearts in the right place. Sometimes we, of course, did not agree, but we always found a way to contribute to our community. I loved that in IU because I found I was welcomed. That is extremely important, and which was a different kind of welcoming I experienced at Reed and Harvard, MIT, et cetera. Because the welcoming in Cambridge is probably based on the fact that majority of the population in the academic institutions there are international. So 60%+ of graduate students are from abroad, et cetera. You know, faculty is quite in that mix. So when I came to NIU, I decided to give it a few years, and I could survive with my integrity, although I did face adversity and other challenges, of course. Everybody does at some point, especially if you're of international origin. But overall, NIU has allowed me to survive with my integrity. That is why I never left it again, although I did get another offer when I was teaching there from, you know, the Chicago area. I live in that, you know, I live in the big city, so to speak. I left DeKalb quite a long time ago. But I never left NIU despite it all, simply because I found the answer to be positive to my initial question at NIU. NIU had the guts and the courage to accept me as who I am. So thank you.
The last question I've got for you is the one that we end all of our interviews with. And I think that we've been spending kind of this whole conversation talking about this, and you could go in so many different directions with the answer, but just what's something about education you wish more people knew?
Ah, formal education or education in general?
Up to you.
Okay. See, I always answer questions with questions. What people don't know about education is the joy it brings, the joy of learning. And it is armistice. Because the natural curiosity that people bring in to our education institutions are destroyed pretty quickly. So we are not good at reminding the joy of learning or teaching the joy of learning. So I'm all my efforts are to transmit that message. It's based on that, you know, and my publications facing the public as well, the upcoming ones. The joy of learning. I've never enjoyed life more than at moments when I learned something, I figured out something about life, myself, about anything that always relates to the human being. And there are other moments, of course, that made me very happy. When I see the best, the brilliant, the real essence of humanity at work, in the selfless, altruistic actions of people, despite adversity and against violence. So those are the moments that make me most happy. So I'm sharing both. And education can encompass both. As I've earlier said earlier, see, that word order is a Turkish reminiscence. the parallelism between social activism and education. I'm not talking about indoctrination, which I'm completely against. I'm talking about the pure joy of understanding. That is bliss.
That was all I had for you. I cannot thank you enough for making the time and sharing all of that with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the wonderful questions.
That was Northern Illinois University Distinguished Teaching Professor Dr. Gulsat Aygin, Gulsad again is a world-renowned linguistics teacher, author, and translator. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. Send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And please do continue to send your story ideas as well so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. And wherever you're in the podcast, please do subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it. If you like what we do, it really is the best way to help out and make sure we get even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to the Teacher's Lounge newsletter to keep up to date with everything going on with the show. You can find a link to do that on this episode's webpage over at WNIJ.org. A big thank you again to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of the show. And I've been your host, Peter Medlin. We'll be back with even more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.